Audio clips from Book of Virginia Aronson, Celestial Healing, from -99. This text excerpt was sent from an acquaintance and is here made as an audio file, to personally get a certain overview of the book, which I do not have time to study or read in the usual way. Also note that there are probably many text errors here due to a perhaps poor scanning. From Part 1. It happened to us. Cancer cure. A resident of New Smyrna Beach, a lovely coastal town just south of Daytona Beach, Florida, Lynn Plaskett is a respected leader in her community, where she is known for her activism in the preservation of natural resources. She is also a vocal advocate for the less fortunate and has served on a number of community service committees, including the Council on Aging, Commission on the Status of Women, and Habitat for Humanity. Lynn was elected a county councilwoman for Volusia County in 1994. For the past 10 years, she has worked full-time as the Assistant Director of Community Development for the nearby city of Edgewater. An artist and writer, Lynn has published poetry and songs. She co-authored a play that was staged at the Los Angeles Performing Arts Theater. She is currently writing a memoir. With husband Bill, a journeyman lineman, Lynn has 6 children. She is 47 years old. Lynn was the first experiencer I interviewed for this book. Over a long weekend in 1997, my family and I drove up the east coast of Florida to Lynn's log cabin-style home, nestled in a forested glen a few miles from the interstate highway. I felt nervous, unsure as to what this woman would be like. In 1996, there had been quite a bit of publicity throughout the state while Lynn was running for re-election to her county council seat because she had appeared on national television, openly discussing her UFO experience and celestial healing. At the time, I was not very interested in extraterrestrial matters, but I remembered Lynn's bravery and willingness to risk her career. She lost the election. As soon as Lynn opened the screen door, my anxiety about meeting an ET experiencer rapidly diminished. A warm, energetic woman, Lynn welcomed us into her cozy home, introducing us to several talkative children, her smiling husband, 2 large dogs, and, later on, some hyper turkeys and cuddly bunnies kept in big pens in the spacious backyard. While my son played with her 6-year-old on a huge blue trampoline under the massive oak trees, Lynn and I talked. Here is her story in her own words. LL, the eldest of 6 children, and my mother raised all of us on her own. We were pretty poor, but we were happy and did not realize that we were poor. When I married the father of my oldest child, Clifford, we moved to Santa Barbara. The marriage didn't work out, so we separated. My mother, brother, and sisters had moved to Long Beach, where my sister Kathy and I decided to get an apartment together. Kathy was working the night shift in a donut shop, and I was going to school full-time during the day to learn mechanical engineering. My sister is a wonderful person and she loved Clifford, so our living arrangement worked out real well. In May of 1975, when I was 1 month shy of my 25th birthday, I went to the walk-in clinic at UCLA Medical Center to get my annual pap smear done so that I could refill my prescription for birth control pills. It was a zoo, swarming with people, a gray place with a cold and uncaring roll-em-in and roll-em-out atmosphere. I thought, thank God I only have to go through this once a year. One day soon after, I received a postcard in the mail indicating that there was something wrong with my pap test results and that I needed to contact my doctor right away. I went back to the clinic, where they did a biopsy, taking a little sample of tissue from the cervix. The results were conclusive. I had cervical cancer. I was pretty frightened. The doctor explained that they would do a procedure called a cone biopsy, excising a large section of the cervix, shaped like a cone, hopefully to remove all of the cancerous material. But just in case the cancer had infiltrated my womb, the doctor said to prepare myself for a possible hysterectomy. How do I do that? I asked. I was 24 years old. Even though I didn't want any more children at the time as I was a single mother, I still felt confused. When somebody tells you they're going to take all you have, you start having second thoughts. I got really frightened, and went home feeling dazed and sorry for myself. My sister Kathy agreed to watch Clifford, who was only 3, for the time that I would need in the hospital. I checked in early and underwent chest x-rays, blood tests, a physical exam, another physical exam, and another. We were scheduled to go into surgery the next day, but the doctors came into my room and asked me some strange questions. "Have you been feeling tired lately?" one asked. When I said, "No, not really," they all looked at each other. "How long have you had that lump in your neck?" another doctor asked. I said, "What lump?" "I hadn't noticed it, the swollen lymph node just above my right collarbone, because it was just under the skin and barely visible." "We see something unusual in your chest x-ray," one of the doctors told me. "So we're going to postpone your operation for a couple of days. We need to make sure you're otherwise in good health before we perform surgery." I thought, what else could possibly go wrong? 2 days later, they performed the cervical cone biopsy and took a sample of the lymph node at the same time. Then they rolled me into a room with 5 other female patients. One woman had had her stomach and part of her bladder removed. Another had had brain surgery. My case seemed minor in comparison. The doctors dropped by during their rounds. An intern introduced himself and another doctor, the chief oncology resident, who said, "Lynn, we have some good news and some bad news. What news do you want to hear first?" I said, "The good news, I guess." So they told me that they did not need to perform the hysterectomy, that all of the cancerous tissue was removed with the cone biopsy. Tears filled my eyes as I thanked them. "But the surgeon indicated you will never have children due to extensive ovarian scar tissue," they added. Then they told me the bad news. The biopsy of the lymph node indicated that I had another cancer of some sort. And when a specialist looked at my x-rays, there was a malignant tumor in my lungs. Other tests showed cancer in my kidneys, spleen, liver, and bone marrow. They concluded that I had a then rare form of cancer called convoluted T-cell lymphoma. They said it was typically a childhood cancer, and they had never seen it in an adult before. The 3 cases they were aware of were infants at New York Children's Hospital. The doctors indicated that they would contact the New York doctors to try to figure out how to treat my case. In the meantime, I said, "I've got this disease. What are you going to do for me? What are my chances?" The intern responded, "To be perfectly honest with you, we think you have about 3 months left." I said, "What?" The doctors explained that the cancer had progressed and that it was a very aggressive type of cancer. It had already infiltrated my entire body except for, possibly, my stomach and brain. "Wait a minute," I said. "I just came in here for some birth control pills and you're telling me I have 3 months to live? Are you sure you don't have the wrong person? I have no symptoms. I'm not tired. I don't feel sick. I just don't understand. This is too much for me to fathom." They were very considerate. They explained a lot of it to me, or tried to. And they said they needed to get a protocol set up for me, to see if they could do something for me, at least to prolong my life a little. I was thinking, "My God, of course," I started crying. The intern sat and held my hand. He actually had tears in his eyes. I think it was the first time he'd had to tell somebody as young as I was that they were going to die. He sat with me for quite a while, comforting me, talking. Then I told him I had to go home. He said, "Lynn, you can't go home, you need to stay in the hospital. You're a very sick woman." I told him I had a 3-year-old son at home, I've got arrangements to make for my son, things I need to clear up. And I'll need to grieve in private. I can't sit here and grieve in a room full of strangers. I need my privacy right now. Of course, it was against hospital regulations. I would have to sign out against medical advice. He said, "You've really got to let us try to help you. If you leave, your chances are slim to none." I said, "But I need to go home for just one night." I was begging him. He said he would see what he could do. When he returned later, he told me that I could go home for the night. but I had to promise to return early the next morning. You have to promise me that you'll return before the 7 a.m. shift change, he said. I guess there was a certain time period for outings, and if the patient was gone for longer, they would be automatically discharged from the hospital. So I promised. I called my sister and told her I was coming home, that the cone biopsy had been a success. I decided to tell her the rest in person when I got there. I was thinking that I would just go home, sit down and explain everything to Kathy, and we would work something out. When I got home, nobody was there. I started pacing around the apartment. I was really beside myself. I sketched a picture of myself, of how I felt inside. I sat and stared out the window. I felt so lonely. Finally, I went into the bedroom I shared with Clifford, to lie down and wait for them. The bedroom was small, just big enough for twin beds, a small table, and a dresser. There was a large sliding glass window, maybe 2 by 4 feet wide, which was open. I began to cry. Hard. Then I was, moaning. I have never cried like that in my entire life, before or since that day. It was coming from the depths, the bowels of my soul. At first, I was crying for myself. I was thinking, what have I done to deserve this? I'm a good person. Things like this aren't supposed to happen to people who have a good heart and try to do the right thing. After I finished crying for myself, I began to cry for my son. I looked at his empty bed, the neat array of stuffed animals. I was thinking, what about him? He's too young to understand. When I die, all he's going to remember is that I left him. And I'm all he has. It is just so unfair. I probably cried for several hours. I was completely exhausted. It was getting dark by the time I was all cried out. I just lay there, feeling numb. Then I became aware of a humming sound, an electrical buzzing type of noise. It seemed to be emanating from the wall behind my head. It sounded like a small generator or other piece of machinery. I assumed it was one of the neighbors, working on something. The room began to fill up with fog-like smoke. It was gradual, so I lay there thinking, maybe I need to get up and close the window. But as the fog thickened into a dense white cloud, I realized that my body was paralyzed. I couldn't move, it was as if I were frozen in time. It was weird because I knew something was happening to me. I didn't understand what it was, but I wasn't afraid. I felt completely relaxed. There was no fear whatsoever. By this time, the whole room was engulfed in this cold white fog. I tried to focus on the ceiling light fixture, but I couldn't see it. The next thing I knew, my body was levitating off the bed. I levitated up around a foot. All of a sudden, something came in through the window. It was a disc-shaped object, about 8 to 10 inches across, 4 to 6 inches tall, with a slightly raised top. It looked like a frisbee, only much thicker. It had little rectangular openings like windows around the edge, which were radiating different colors, yellow, red, blue, green. The disc was gyrating slowly in a counterclockwise direction. It was just above my head, hovering. I was looking right at this thing and it was stationary for a moment. Through the little windows, I could see these soft lights. Then the disc began to move, slowly. It moved from my head down to my feet, almost in a scanning motion. Then it moved back up again. It scanned from head to toe and back again 3 times. But never actually touched me. For some unknown reason, there was no sense of fear, anxiety, or even concern. I felt so completely relaxed. After scanning my body, the disc left through the window, just the way it had come in. The smoke dissipated, and I was gently lowered back onto my bed. The humming sound vanished. All sense of time had completely escaped me. I had no idea if hours had passed or mere seconds. But a kind of veil of security seemed to fall upon me. I felt tranquil, serene. So, I just rolled over and went to sleep. I knew everything was going to be all right. I woke up the next morning and went out onto the balcony. The sky was azure, the most exquisite shade of blue I'd ever seen. The air was fresh, fragrant with flowers. I felt revitalized, and humble in the face of nature's beauty. I also felt completely refreshed. Kathy and Clifford had not returned. I telephoned my mother, who said they had spent the night with her. I asked her to meet me at the hospital, where the doctors could explain everything to her. Then I rushed back to the hospital. I didn't want to get the intern in trouble. When the oncologist came by on his rounds, I told him, "You know what? I'm not going to die. I'm telling you right now, I am not going to die. I'm going to be fine." He looked at me carefully and said, "Yeah, okay, Lynn." He was just pacifying me, as if to say, "Whatever works for you is fine. And now we're going to proceed." Perhaps I didn't recall at the time what had happened the night before, because I'm sure I would have shared that with him. Years later, when I asked the oncologist if he remembered me telling him about my experience, he said no. I thought I had told him, but he certainly would have remembered if I had. He did recall that I said I wasn't going to die. The doctors got a protocol of drugs from New York Children's Hospital. It was chemotherapy, so some of the drugs had been used with other types of cancer. But some of the drugs they were going to try on me were purely experimental. They warned me about some of the complications that might occur. So I asked them, "If I take all of these experimental drugs you want me to take, how long are you going to give me to live?" And they said that, based on the chemotherapy results with the babies in New York, I could possibly live almost a year. A year? But, I thought, what do I have to lose? I agreed to take the drugs. All of them. Within 2 days of the night I'd spent at home, the tumor in my chest had been drastically reduced. But the doctors did not tell me this. I began some of the chemotherapy a few days later. Within 4 months, I was in complete remission. Some of the drugs they used made me so sick. It was as if I'd been abducted by the American Medical Association. It was as if they had, with my permission, abducted me and were performing experiments on me. And I was getting deathly ill from the drugs they were giving me. I had never felt sick at all from the disease. But the chemotherapy was making me sicker and sicker. I lost all my hair. My reflexes were gone. But, within a 4 month period, I was in total remission. The doctors were extremely surprised. They were pleased. After 4 months of their horrendous treatment, I asked the oncologist if the chemotherapy had cured me. And he said, "Lynn, I have to be honest with you. In my professional opinion, 99.9% of your cure is your mental attitude toward the disease. Because you said early on that you were simply not going to die." I went back to school full time. I graduated in the top 10 of my class, and the California State Department of Rehabilitation gave me an award, Rehabilitant of the Year. I was totally surprised. My life returned to normal. I entered the workforce, remarried in 1978, and moved to Florida. Bill and I had 2 more children. Bill had 3 when we met, so we raised the 6 kids together. I had been told over and over that I would not have any more children, so the doctors couldn't figure it out. One evening in 1981, I was sitting in my living room reading a book. The TV was on, and I was half listening to some magazine program. There were 2 gentlemen on the show who claimed they had been abducted by a UFO. They also claimed to have made a tape recording of what they called the mothership, which had hovered over their boat while they were fishing. They played the tape on TV. I sat straight up in my chair. It was the exact same sound I'd heard in my bedroom that night back in May of 1975. And then I knew, I said, "Oh, my God, that's what it was." And this was the very first time I had connected what had happened that night to any sort of reality whatsoever. That was when I finally realized the disc was an unidentified flying object, or something extraterrestrial in nature. Until that night in 1981, I had no idea what my experience with the disc was about. When I told other people, family members and a few friends, they had said, "Maybe it was an angel, or maybe it was God, coming to you in the only form you would accept." I was open to all kinds of explanations, because I had no idea what it was. Until that night in 1981, the connection was made instantaneously at that point, and I knew exactly what had happened. It was like the light bulb came on. And I said, "Oh, so that's what happened to me." Kathy later confirmed that she had heard the humming sound, too. She had returned to the apartment with Clifford and, opening the front door, heard a loud, electrical-type noise. "And something told me, 'Don't go in,'" Kathy explained. "So I said to Clifford, 'Let's go over to Grandma's.' We had never talked about this because it had simply never come up. I cannot say that I know why the UFO healing experience happened to me. But I do know there's a reason. And since that night in 1975, other things have happened to me. Things have happened over underscore the years that I did not connect to that experience until recently. Now, with all the research I have done on this topic, I realize that I was given a gift. I was saved, for a reason. Part of that reason is, I believe, to share my story with the world. My experience was a very positive one, but I told very few people about it. How do you tell people you believe you've been cured of cancer by a UFO without having them think you're crazy?" In 1996, a producer at the Maury Povich show called me. They were doing a show on abductions and begged me to appear. I said, "Look, I'm in the middle of a re-election campaign for the county council. I really don't think it would be a good time for me to appear on your show. But I discussed the idea with my family, and everyone encouraged me to do it." In September of 1996, I went on the show and told my story. I came out publicly because I know that if it had not been for my UFO experience, I would not be here today. I know that in my heart, in my case, I know that my experience was 99.9% responsible for my recovery from what was, at that time, a rare and fatal form of cancer. I was given a gift. People ask if I have any way of getting in contact with these beings. I hate the word alien. It's so degrading, but I never saw any beings. I saw this disc. And I cannot say what it was, except that I now know it was extraterrestrial in essence because some wonderful things have happened to me as a result of that experience. I was healed. I also developed an ability to see things in order to help people. For example, when a person is missing something, I know where their lost things are. I can tell a person whether or not they will get a job they've applied for. I can do things like this. I don't make it a practice, or do it for just anybody. But I was given this gift of sight in conjunction with the healing experience. And it has helped in a lot of circumstances. Another gift is a healing ability. For example, if one of my children had an ear infection, I'd lay my hand on them and concentrate, and take the pain away. For so long, I thought this ability to heal was a natural ability that all mothers had. Now I see it as a gift as well. A couple of months ago, I went to the doctor for a chest X-ray. I'm a healthy person, considering the fact that I smoke. Well, I know it's not good for me. But I've been smoking cigarettes since I was 12 years old. The doctor showed me my X-ray. He said, "Look at this. There is no scar from the malignant tumor. And there's no indication here that you smoke. No sign whatsoever." I am learning more and more every day about the gifts that have been bestowed on me since the healing experience almost 25 years ago. And I believe that coming forward to tell my story is not the end for me. There's still something else that I'm supposed to do. I'm not sure yet what that is. What I do know is, it's not over yet. From Chapter 2, John Hunter Gray is a sociologist, community organizer, and well-known specialist in race, cultural relations and UFO/ET encounters. The former chairman of the Indian Studies Department at the University of North Dakota, Gray's career has encompassed multi-ethnic organizing, civil rights organizing, and community organizing for American Indians. His father was Micmac/Abenaki/Mohawk Indian, his mother Scottish. In the 1960s, Gray, then known as John R. Salter, Jr. He legally changed his name in 1995 to honor a Native American ancestral name, served as the organizer of Mississippi's Jackson Movement, one of America's first massive nonviolent civil rights protests. As chronicled in the 1996 movie Ghosts of Mississippi, and Gray's own book, Jackson, Mississippi, the movement was beset by violence, leading to the murder of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. One of the last to see Evers alive, Gray himself was the target of violence, beaten four times by police and local whites, his house shot up by night riders. At the famous Woolworth sit-in in 1963, Gray, who was on the faculty of a nearby black college, and two of his students were beaten and smeared with condiments at a breakfast counter while FBI agents looked on. Gray has received numerous honors and awards for his social justice work, including the North Dakota Martin Luther King, Jr. Award for Social Justice Activities. He speaks regularly at colleges and universities and is frequently interviewed in the media about social justice issues, Native American history and sociology, and occasionally UFOs and ETs. A native of Arizona, Gray now lives in Idaho with his wife, Aldry. They have four children and eight grandchildren. He is 64 years old. These days, John Gray is exceedingly careful about agreeing to conduct interviews on the subject of his personal experiences with ETs. He feels he has been too often misquoted and misrepresented in the media, so he usually restricts his public discussions on celestial matters to academic forums and a few select media appearances. When I first contacted John, he politely refused to be interviewed for this book. Only after I reassured him that the focus of the book and the UFO/ET experiences discussed would be positive and healing in nature did he agree to participate. A soft-spoken man, John Hunter Gray combines the engaging storytelling of a good teacher with the analytical skills of a sociologist when he recounts the credible, incredible events of his own celestial healings. State candidly at the outset that I see the ET visitors, the so-called alien humanoids, as friendly and with positive motivations and beneficial effects. I am inclined also to see them as essentially one race, quite similar to ourselves in many ways, but a good jump ahead evolution-wise. Based on my own experiences and on direct and collateral contact with hundreds of other experiencers, I view the ETs as friendly but understandably cautious given our challenging world. As a long-term community organizer, I can see that like all good organizers, the ETs are working at the grassroots level. I very much believe they are involved in a long-term endeavor that involves 1. Helping some people on Earth keep on keeping on in the save the world business, sharpening our social justice sensitivity, and 2. Sensitizing humanity on a step-by-step basis to the presence of friendly ET life in our solar neighborhood with whom we will ultimately interact. But let me say that if you had asked me on the morning of March 20, 1988, if I thought there was something out there, I would have said, probably, maybe, but I don't really know. I didn't really give a damn about it one way or the other. On March 20, 1988, I left North Dakota with my then 23-year-old son, John 3, for a speaking trip in Mississippi and Louisiana. Several days before our departure, I had, quite uncharacteristically because I am always a straight line, no darling driver, decided to proceed through the lonely, isolated, narrow and winding roads of the rugged Mississippi River Hill country of southwestern Wisconsin. In retrospect, it was clear that the route I had picked some days before for the first day of our junket was certainly not logical. When we were at La Crosse late that first afternoon, we were fully awake, vigorous, well-fed, with myself driving. Our firm and clear intent was to keep on the chosen route. But then, once into that isolated setting, episodes of gentle, double amnesia began, and we were further diverted onto roads even more illogical and eventually obscure. Matters culminated in the late afternoon and early evening with 90 minutes of missing time in the darkened woods near Richland Center, Wisconsin. The next morning, we had a close-up and fully conscious sighting of a UFO spacecraft 5 miles east of Peoria, Illinois. At 10:14 a.m., There was no traffic around us or ahead of us in either direction.